The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A joy to come and to see so many of you. Is it too soft? Okay. Is it better? Yeah. So, yeah, good evening. And it's always a treat to be here and to see so many of you making time in your busy week to come and meditate. I remember when I started coming here many years ago, every time I came, regardless if I was able to settle my mind a bit or not, I felt better when I went home. I felt like I had been at the car wash and I had been washed outside and inside too. So I hope this evening will have a similar effect. So how about if people who consider themselves pretty new to these teachings would raise their hands? So that's about half of you. Okay, so I'll shape the talk accordingly. So tonight I want to talk to you about one of the discourses of the Buddha. You know, the teachings that we have, called the Dharma, are presented in the form of discourses. And this particular discourse is not very well known, but I find it very meaningful and interesting too. So it is about a young man by the name of Pukkasati, who was from a noble family, and he was regarded by people as being particularly wise and admired, and he had devoted himself at some point to studying the teachings of the Buddha and was inspired to the point that he decided to leave his privileged life the way the Buddha did. So he goes off to look for the Buddha and hopefully become one of his followers. So the discourse begins describing how the Buddha himself was walking around several parts of India, giving his teachings. And at the beginning of this discourse, or sutta, the Buddha arrived at the house of a potter by the name of Bhagawa. And so he asked Bhagawa if it's possible to stay overnight in his shed. And the potter answers, "If it is no inconvenience for you," well, first says the Buddha, "if it's no inconvenience for you, Bhagawa, I will stay for one night in your shed." "It's no inconvenience for me, Lord, but there is a wanderer who has already taken up residence there. If he gives his permission, you may stay there as long as you like." Now, as it turns out, that the wanderer who was happening to stay at Bhagawa's shed was none other than Pukkasati. So the Buddha got to the shed and approached this young monk and says, "If it is no inconvenience for you, monk, I will stay one night in the shed." And Pukkasati answers, "The shed is roomy, my friend. Stay as you like." So then the Buddha starts to gather some dry grass in order to prepare a place for him to sit, to meditate. He sits down, crosses his legs, sits completely dignified, straight, closes his eyes, and sets his mind to be mindful. It is said in the sutta that he meditated throughout the night into the early hours of the morning. And Pukkasati did the same thing. So in the early hours of the morning, the Buddha had a thought. "How inspiring is the way this clansman behaves? what if I were to question him? So he says to Pukkasati, out of dedication to whom, monk, have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? Of whose Dhamma do you approve? So Dhamma or Dharma is the same word. And Pukkasati answers, there is my friend Gotama, the contemplative, a son of the Sakyans, gone forth from a Sakyan clan. So it's referring to the Buddha. That blessed one is my teacher. It is of that blessed one's Dharma that I approve. Then Pukkasati goes on to describe the Buddha as follows. He is the awakened one, a blessed one, consummate in knowledge and conduct, an expert with regard to the world, unexcelled as a trainer of those people fit to be tamed, the teacher of divine and human beings. That's quite a wonderful series of compliments, right? Now, imagine that either of us were in that situation. We've just heard this amazing series of compliments. We would be bursting with enthusiasm to say, it's me who you're looking for, right? So here is, I find, the first moment that is an interesting moment for all of us to see, oh, you know, look what the Buddha does. So he says, Pukkasati has finished his statement, by adding that out of the dedication to the Buddha, he abandoned his privileged life, that he considers the Buddha as his teacher, and that the Buddha's teachings are the ones that he approves. Okay, so as I tell you the way the Buddha answers to Pukkasati's comment, keep in mind the following words. These are part of the Dharma, of the suttas. Whoever sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. So now let's see what the Buddha is going to say. First he says, have you ever seen that blessed one before? On seeing him, would you recognize him? And Pukkasati says, no, my friend, I've never seen the blessed one before, nor on seeing him would I recognize him. We know that that's exactly what has happened, right? Then the thought occurred to the Buddha, it is out of dedication to me that this clansman has gone forth. What if I were to teach him the Dhamma? So he said to Pukkasati, I will teach you the Dhamma, monk. Listen and pay close attention while I speak. As you say, friend, replied Pukkasati. Perhaps he was being polite. You know, he's going to listen to a fellow monk about the teachings. Now, the fact that he refers to the Buddha as friend, you know, gives it away that he obviously doesn't recognize the Buddha. And then the Buddha starts this way. He says, the first thing he says as he's going to present himself, he says, this person, which is very impersonal, right? If I say this person and I'm in front of somebody, it could mean me or it could be you, right? We don't know. So this person is very neutral. This person has 6 properties, 6 sensory organs, 18 considerations, and 4 determinations. So imagine you are in a party holding your drink and somebody says, glad to meet you. This person is a person, etc. With 6 properties, 6 sensory organs, 18 considerations, and 4 determinations. I think we would be rather dumbfounded by this introduction. So we are so accustomed to the traditional, my name is, my work is, I am, I have, I like, and here is my card, right? So what does the Buddha mean with this list? When we hear this list, they can be rather abstract, and it's easy to lose interest. But let's look at them a little bit and see how is it that they relate to us. When he talks about the six properties, he's talking about this body here. This body has six properties. The property of earth, which it means anything solid in the body is considered earth. Water, anything in this body that has liquid, that is liquid. Wind, we can say anything that moves in the body, and there's also gases in the body. Fire, the changing temperatures in the body, you know, when we eat and we digest, there's heat is produced, the temperature changes. Then it goes on to add space, which is an unusual one. So space, referring to the various spaces that we have, or orifices that we have in the body, the mouth, the nostrils, etc. And the last one is consciousness. So that aspect of the knowing, you know, the consciousness, it's with us until we die. So those are the six properties. So far, it's all of us, right? Then the six contact sensory organs. Well, we know our senses, right? The eye, the nose, the tongue, the hearing, the touching. So we have the five senses that we usually have, plus in Buddhism we add a sixth one, and that's the mind, the thinking. That's kind of unusual that we put in the Dharma in the same category, the thinking, with all the other senses. But to me, that already points to a considerable difference of how we relate to thinking. And then the 18 considerations. So those are referring to how we perceive. Now we take, again, the six senses, the eye, the nose, etc. But with each one, we're going to see, for example, with the eyes, eyes seeing a form. And one considers a form that can be a basis of joy, right? We see something, it's a basis of joy. One considers a form that acts as a basis of distress. We see something else also can be a form of distress. And one considers a form that can act as a basis of equanimity. So these three, joy, distress, and equanimity, are the same one for eyes, nose, ears, tongue, the body, tangibles, touch, and mind. Yeah, so the six times three, there's our 18. So, as I said before, this list can seem very abstract and, you know, it's like, well, okay, so what? So I was thinking like an example if we bring it to an example of real life, then suddenly the list clicks with us. A few years ago, I was invited to give an introductory talk on mindfulness in a community center in Millbrae. So there was a group of people who never meditated before, didn't know anything about Buddhism, about mindfulness. And so I gave a little introduction, and we had a little meditation. And after the meditation, we went around, and I asked people to say a little bit what their experience was like. I got to a woman that looked really distressed. I could just tell the way she was fidgeting and sitting. And I said, well, how did it go? Oh, terrible, terrible. I said, well, what happened? And I said, well, you know, didn't you hear all that noise? Terrible. All that noise on the other side of the wall. Don't they know that I'm meditating? And I just looked at her and I thought, oh dear. No, this is now the polar opposite than what the Buddha is talking here, right? So not only was for her, as we say, the one considers a sound that act as a base for distress. Okay, let's say it was unpleasant. We can, sometimes sounds are unpleasant, right? But we can leave it at that, and that's what the Buddha is pointing at. It can be a joy, it can be a distress, or it can be a source of equanimity. But what this woman did out of complete delusion is to act to the sense of hearing the layer of her story of this people next door are really inconsiderate. They are disturbing the meditation. Well, first of all, I'm sure that people didn't even know that we were there, even less that we were meditating, and even less about her. So here we just have a crass, extreme example of what this list is pointing towards, right? We are aiming towards what in the Dharma says, in the hearing, just the hearing. Are we able to do that? In the seeing, just the seeing. I mean, can we notice when we see somebody that immediately so many comments come in the mind, and we have a whole story about somebody in no time? So it can be really a relief to begin to become conscious of this commentary and gently stop it. Or at least at the maybe at the end of the commentary and not believe it. Not allow it to shape our experience. So the last, if you remember, we haven't gotten to the last list that he gives. You know, at the end he gives the four resolves or determinations. And these are wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. For beautiful quality. If we look at the whole answer itself that the Buddha gives, he's presenting a very, very impersonal. He's presenting a impersonal construction of this entity here that is just a series of processes. So when we present ourselves as these series of processes, then we are beginning to free ourselves from the I, the me, and the mine. So this is a radical, radical new way of looking at ourselves, at our experience, and at how we present ourselves in the world. So we can ask ourselves, how would our lives unfold if we were able to live in a way that was free of this lens of seeing everything through the I, through the me, through the mine? As I thought about direct experiences that I've had connected with this topic, I remembered a very a painful experience that I had a couple years ago. A friend of mine invited me to come along with her to the San Francisco Opera. So there we were, the two of us, before the performance. We were just walking up and down these beautiful spaces in the theater. I just felt very festive, the chandeliers, and people are wearing their best clothing. It's a bit of a performance, we know that. So I was walking down, and suddenly my eye just fell on this elderly gentleman who was walking towards us. And so I was kind of looking at him, and suddenly, as if hit by lightning, he collapsed right in front of us, hitting his head against the hard, hard floor. I think it was a marble floor. So it's like we both just stood there totally scared, and it was so dramatic. You could see bleeding, the blood, the red blood on this white, white floor. Now, luckily, my friend, who had some medical training, knew right away what to ask him to determine if he had had a stroke or not. Then we just carefully helped him up and brought him over to some seats that were on the side. And yeah, I helped him with the handkerchief that he had to try to stop the bleeding from his head while my friend went off to get the paramedics. So I sat with this gentleman for a while in silence. And while we were waiting, as soon as he recovered a little bit from the initial shock, I was so surprised what came out of his mind. Just imagine, this man just really had a tremendous shock to his body. And so we're sitting there, and he starts to talk to me. And he says, "You know, I want you to know that I am a very successful businessman. I am in the fabric business, and I sell fabric to the most important department stores. And everybody knows me in that field." And then I see him with shaky hands, bloody too, take out his wallet, take out a card, and say, here is my card. I didn't know if I should cry. I mean, it was so poignant. And, you know, what happens is when we are in a situation where what props us up, what gives us a sense of power, a sense of status, of our identity. Think of when you have been, if you've been in the hospital, and all your clothing are taken away, and you're given this nondescript little awful whatever, the gown, right? What happens to us? So there comes this need to immediately prop up the ego again, prop up the identity. And I saw that so nakedly that time. I knew it was not the right time to say anything, but I so much wanted to say, you don't have to prove yourself to me. Just by being human, just by being alive, you deserve being loved and respected. So when I was young, I remember writing my first resume. And, you know, being young, I didn't have much to show off. So I tried to make my meager experience count. And a man who had, in my mind, a lot more experience than me and was a lot older than me said, "You know, I will look at your resume and give you some feedback if you want." So I gave it to him when I finished, and he looked at it. He didn't look too impressed and handed it back to me, and he said, "You have to learn to toot your horn a little louder." I never heard that expression before, but I was I was really intrigued by that. And he said, "You know, with that kind of resume, not only nobody's going to take note of you, but even less offer you employment." So that's the message that we all get when we're young, right? Toot your horn loud. So no wonder there's such a cacophony in the world, because we're all tooting our horn as loud as possible. And then we can't really hear each other. We can't hardly hear the other one because we're so busy trying to promote ourselves. And this leaves us really feeling very isolated. So let's come back to Pukkasati. The last list that the Buddha presents of the four resolutions or determinations of wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. They, at some point in the sutta, are presented as a practice. So they're not something that you just got and you have it for guaranteed the rest of your life. But they are paired with a verb, which means this is something that we continuously practice. And so he says, do not neglect wisdom. Protect truth. Cultivate relinquishment and train in peace. So, the idea is the four resolves teach us how to live untroubled. Untroubled by our experience. So we learn to be untroubled with whatever is happening right now, if it's pleasant or if it's unpleasant. The discourse goes on to say that anybody who is established in these resolutions won't be swept away by the tides of conceiving, you know, by the tides of our thinking, of our cognitive mind. And when we no longer are swept away by the tides of conceiving, then we are said to be a peaceful sage. I like that expression, a peaceful sage. So the Buddha calls this I-making or this selfing a disease. A disease in itself is not wrong, but it hurts when we're sick, right? It's uncomfortable. So now we come to another crucial point in the story of Pukkasati. Just realize the Buddha has just finished presenting him his teaching. Pukkasati hears the Dharma, and now he knows who he has in front of him. Pukkasati thinks, surely the teacher has come to me. Surely the one well gone has come to me. Surely the rightly self-awakened one has come to me. Getting up from his seat, arranging his upper robe over one shoulder and bowing down with his head at the Blessed One's feet, he said, a transgression has overcome me, Lord, in that I was so foolish, so muddle-headed, and so unskilled as to assume that it was proper to address the Blessed One as friend. May the Blessed One please accept this confession of my transgression as such, so that I may achieve restraint in the future. So, this is, I find, a very beautiful moment. And here is where we really see what the Buddha means when he says, when you see the Dharma, you will see me. So Pukkasati has seen the Dharma, and in the moment that he takes in the Dharma, he sees the Buddha. Now he recognizes the Buddha. So there's a little bit more about the story. Pukkasati, having recognized the Buddha, said, may I receive a full ordination from you? And the Buddha says, are your robes and bowl complete? So you need certain requisites for the ordination. And Pukkasati says, no. So then he says, well, you, in order to be ordained, you have to get your requisites. So Pukkasati goes off to get what he needs for his ordination. And then something kind of surprising happens. He is killed by a cow that is on the loose. And that's kind of like a surprising ending, right? It's like, Why? Why? I mean, he's just found the Buddha, and he's about to be ordained, and he's killed. So it's a good question, right, to ask, well, what does it mean? Why is Pukkasati having to die at that point? I mean, there are many ways that one could interpret, and it's really up to each one of us to interpret. I like very much the way Gill interprets it, and that is that it perhaps could point to the fact that we never know how long we have to live. We postpone sometimes the things that are truly meaningful to us, right? We say, you know, right now I can do whatever, something that's really not that meaningful, it's not so important, doesn't have any depth for us, but we kind of do it because it's entertaining. And so I think maybe what it is pointing to is do what really is meaningful to you because you don't know how long you have to live. So, as Pukkasati, the idea that as we understand the Dharma more and more, that we begin to make it ourselves, we see that teaching in us, we respect that teaching in us, and then we will also see the Buddha in us. So let's take a little bit of time to be silent. I'd like to invite you to take some time to let this teaching be internalized by you and ask yourself, can I see the Dharma in me? And what does it mean to see these teachings in me? What significance do they have? The most meaningful teachings come when we ask ourselves, what significance does it have for me? How do I understand this? It's this idea of weakening the very solid sense of self that we have, still very foreign to us. And And have we ever had a glimpse of the relief that comes when we begin to pierce these apparently solid me or I? So take a moment now to consider something you would like to share, making the effort to talk about our experience within the Dharma is of great benefit, because what we share, we learn, we clarify in our minds. Might come in the form of a question or simply something that touched you, that you found intriguing. Yeah, so now I'd love to hear from you. Yes.
When you were talking about it's the six senses, is that the word? Six senses? The thinking, and I was thinking about the woman who was disturbed by the noise on the other side of the wall. And I live in a condo, and there's a unit above us, and they don't have any carpeting. Mm. And they have, I think she's a toddler, maybe under 2 years old, and she runs across the floor a couple of times a day. And I work at home, and so when they're new tenants, so when they moved in, and then they're also building furniture. So every day there's boxes from Amazon, and it was so upsetting. You know, I said, I hate living here, and, you know, all my Dharma, like, went out the window, my Dharma practice. And I actually went upstairs. You know, I did have some restraint, because I felt like going up with a skillet. And I just, I knocked on the door, and it happened to be the child's caregiver, you know, nanny or something, and she said, yes, I'll recommend they get some carpeting. I thought, you know, that's a tall order to install some carpeting. But do some things to mute the sound. Yeah. And then I started to notice that little by little it stopped bothering me. And I actually started to find the running back and forth kind of amusing.
Aww.
And I just thought, you know, I have a grandson. I could hear her, you know, this kind of joy. I mean, she's up at 6 o'clock. Pretty much every morning, and she's, you know, she's doing her exercise, whatever she's doing. And I was really surprised. That was, you know, to me, that was a real Dharma lesson.
Mm.
Like, I could hear the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the thing you said about the thinking applied to the hearing was very useful in all of the other senses.
Thank you. That's wonderful. You know, that's a moment where we feel the learning happening, the relief. Oh, yes, I can relate to this very same thing in a different way. and be just so much more free with whatever is happening. Yeah, it's great. Congratulations. Yes, yes.
But then during the silence afterwards, thinking, and somehow this passage came to me, and I don't remember whom or when I heard it before, but it was some Buddhist teaching that said, and you can correct me, something about how how life is.
Yes, very good, exactly. Yeah.
And the only thing that is certain is that it is the transient.
Yeah,
life.
Yes.
And I thought of, the ending and related to that.
Yes.
Yeah,
very, very good observation. There's a passage in the sutta that makes reference to impermanence and Pukkasati dying at the end of the story brings it really home to us. Yes, everything is impermanent and it's very difficult for us to really take it in that we will too die. Yeah. Thank you.
So the list you gave of the four determinations reminded me of the four noble truths. There seemed to be a correlation between those. I don't know if that was just intentional or I made it in my mind.
It
was interesting because I've always heard the four noble truths as the four noble truths. It's never been kind of it's been discussed many times, but never in really a different perspective, and that gave me a slightly different perspective on the Four Noble Truths, which made it, made it more, I don't know why I want to say more natural and less constructed, but maybe just a broader view. I'm just a different perspective in a way.
Yeah, I can see that you could make some parallels. So, yeah, that's the wonderful thing about, reading several of the discourses, because you are learning several aspects of the Dharma from different perspectives. And it just becomes clearer and deeper. Yeah, thank you. Anyone else? Okay, so let's take 1 or 2 minutes of silence, and then we just stop a little earlier.